Okay, success. So this is bio 241, and it's Thursday, September 4th, and we're 1 week away from a test. So if you have any questions, we should talk about that. But let me tell you what chapters are on the test. It's going to be chapters 1, 2, and 3.
No 6.
No 6. We will have 6, but not on the first test.
Okay.
But so we're going to probably finish maybe 6 today. I'm not sure if we're going to finish that today or not. Do we start it? I don't know. All right, so 1, 2, and 3 are going to be on the test. But that still means you have to study. Maybe if you have a huge chemistry background, you don't have to study too much. And you still can do well on the test, I'm sure, if you understand those structures. But I've had students before that had a pretty strong background in chemistry and studied hard for the first test anyway, even though they had a background in chemistry, and they came in and took the test and found it very easy. And so then they thought, well, gee whiz, I'm not going to study for the second test. And then they almost fail the second test. So if you have a strong background in chemistry, don't forget to keep studying like chapter 6 and the subsequent chapters, okay? All right, don't get caught short on that. So chapters 1, 2, and 3 is what's going to be on the test. That's 1 week from today. So sign that sign-in sheet, and let's see. We want to go here. But I suppose before we go there, where did we have the flash quiz? You want to do the... Here. You want to do the flash quiz real quick? What the heck, why not? Just to kind of warm up a little bit. All right, so the flash quiz that's in that video, similar to this, but not quite. All right, it's real similar. So we'll just go through it twice. Once kind of slowly and then once real, really, really fast. Faster than before. So what was that? That was a... Oh, let's go back. How do I go back? That way? Yeah. That's a ribonucleotide. A nucleotide has a base, a ribose sugar of some kind and a phosphate. And this is ribose because you see an OH group here, not just a hydrogen. So that's ribonucleotide. I got to click here. All right, next one. Oh. What was that? That was a functional group. Sulfhydryl group. That sulfhydryl group can, if it's on an amino acid, can form a disulfide bond between another amino acid on a different part of a protein and cause that protein to fold on itself or curl. And it's a covalent bond, so it's a very strong kind of bond, hard to get rid of. We have those kinds of disulfide bridges in our hair when we have, that gives us curly hair, wavy hair, curly kinky hair, whatever. Oh, what's that? Amino group. It's a basic group for what kind of compound that we were looking at? Yeah? A protein in particular, an amino acid, right, has got to have that amino group on it. Okay. Carboxyl group. Does an amino acid have a carboxyl group? Absolutely. That's why we call it an amino acid. It has an amino group plus a carboxyl group on it. Okay, see this CO2H? And this hydrogen can jump off of the molecule and be donated to the solution. What do we call a compound that can donate hydrogen ions to solution? That's an acid, right? So that's why we call that an acidic group, carboxyl group. Phosphate group, and that's an acid as well because that hydrogen can be donated into solution and that one can be donated in as well. All right, so that's an acid. Ooh, that was really fast. That's a monosaccharide, a 6-carbon monosaccharide. Probably this is glucose. And then here is a saturated fatty acid. And here are 3 fatty acids and glycerol, because there's 3 carbons, glycerol, that's going to form a triglyceride. And what kind of reaction is taking place? Dehydration synthesis. Here is a monosaccharide, namely fructose. And then that's a micelle. And what's the molecule that makes up the micelle? Phospholipid. And you can recognize this region here as being what? What is this region here? hydrophobic or nonpolar, and this is hydrophilic or polar, and these are all water molecules around it, right? All right, that was steroids or cholesterol. Don't forget cholesterol is a building block for steroids. And that's a unsaturated fatty acid. And that one, oh, let's go back, take a look at that. Here's that amino group, here's a carboxyl group, so this is just a generic amino acid, and different amino acids have different groups in this position, like maybe a sulfhydryl group. That would be cysteine in that particular case. Okay, oh, that was easy. Phospholipid, yeah, it was glycerol with two fatty acids and a phosphate, so that's a phospholipid. Prostaglandins. Secondary structure, that's an alpha helix in particular. What was that? Deoxyribonucleotide, building block of DNA, right? That's why we call it deoxyribonucleic acid. Hydroxyl group. What molecule is that? That's glycerol. Sort of looks like a three-carbon sugar, but not quite. It's kind of a cross between an alcohol and a sugar. That's a carbonyl group, and here's where we started. That's the ribonucleotide, because it's the OH group right here. Okay, let's see how fast I can do it. Sulfhydryl group. Yeah, amino group. So speak, I'll save my voice, I'll just let you say it. Okay, unless you want me to say it. That's a saturated fatty acid. It's saturated all with the hydrogens. Triglyceride formation. Monosaccharide. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. What's the building block of secondary structure? Primary structure. What does primary structure really mean? Well, there are 20 different amino acids, and each of those 20 different amino acids can be at different locations in the protein. And primary structure just means what amino acids are in the number 1, which amino acid number 2, which is number 3, which is number 4, which is number 5. So a protein is just a big, long chain of amino acids. And primary structure just tells you what amino acid is in which position. Deoxyribonucleic acid, no hydrogen there. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Carbonyl. Ribonucleotide. What is it a building block of?
RNA.
That's right. RNA. That's what RNA is made out of. Ribonucleotides. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group, carboxyl group, phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid. Was that saturated or unsaturated? That's saturated. Okay. Say again? Because of the single bond right here. But the reason why they call it saturated, because on this carbon, we might find some fatty acids that don't have two hydrogens on either side over here. This one is completely filled up with all the possible orbitals with these hydrogens right here, so it's completely saturated with hydrogens in both locations. If it's unsaturated, that means that there's a double bond here and this carbon only has one hydrogen, not two, meaning that it's unsaturated. That's where that term comes from. Okay. Triglyceride formation, monosaccharide, deoxyribonucleotide, building block of DNA, hydroxyl group, glycerol, where did we start? Ooh, carbonyl, ribonucleotide, sulfhydryl, amino, carboxyl, phosphate, monosaccharide. What can monosaccharides build? What is it a building block of? Polysaccharides. Can you give me a specific polysaccharide that's important in our body? Starch is made in plants. In our bodies, it's called glycogen. Glycogen is the polysaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Well, I guess we've done it all a couple times. All right, so that's enough. If we have time, we could go over it again. Oh, but we got Monday, too, still, to do that again. Plus, you should be able to do that on the internet. All right, so what chapter are we in? Three, and then what slide? Somebody was supposed to write down what slide we're on. Okay.
Finishing 38, going up to 39.
Oh, yeah.
We ended up at intron.
Okay. Okay, so here we have a couple things. This, on the top of the figure, we have a nucleic acid that is double-stranded. So what can you tell me about a nucleic acid that is double-stranded? What has it got to be? It's got to be DNA. So you got deoxyribonucleotides that make up both of these strands. All right. And what is the name of that process that uses DNA to make messenger RNA, or to make actually any kind of RNA? Transcription. See, and it's labeled right there, transcription. And it's a one-way arrow. Everybody should be aware of that. So before transcription can take place, what has to happen to this double helix? Yeah, it's got to unzip. We actually call it unzipping. Okay. And it unzips, and then there's an RNA polymerase, which is an enzyme that makes the RNA polymer. RNA is a polymer because it's just repeated subunits over and over and over and over again. That's what a polymer is. And the polymer building block are ribonucleotides. All right, so then we end up with this. Let me get my arrow back. All right, so we end up with this RNA molecule, which is what? Which is complementary to this strand right here in DNA that it came from because of base pairing rules. All right, so this strand of DNA acts as a template on how to put nucleotides together in this RNA molecule. So this RNA polymerase just can't make any kind of RNA molecule. The nucleotides in this RNA have to be complementary to the DNA strand that's being used for transcription. All right, so there's complementary base pairing. So what kind of bases are used in DNA? And what are the base pair rules? GC, AT, and how is RNA different? You don't have any thymine in there. You have uracil, right? And uracil is going to base pair with adenine that we find in the DNA molecule. And the only other difference is that little oxygen atom. A deoxyribose is used in the nucleotide instead of a ribose, which has that oxygen. So this is what we call pre-messenger RNA. And we can see there's different segments. There's this dark band and this light band. The dark band are what we call introns. And as far as we know today, if you find out otherwise, you should let me know because it's very interesting. These introns right here, we don't think have any value to us whatsoever. That's really hard to believe. So I guess I believe that we're going to find out that it has some important function, but we have no clue what they're doing. But they can't be left in the messenger RNA. They have to be removed. There are enzymes that remove them and then splice the usable segments of RNA back together. So the usable segments are what we call exons. And in this particular strand of messenger RNA, how many exons do we see? One, two, and over here. So we see two non-usables, which we call introns, and three usable lengths of messenger RNA. And when they're spliced together, okay, we get a competent messenger RNA that can be used to make up protein. We're maybe going to look and see how that happens. Okay. Well, the human genome, what the heck is a genome again? It's just all the genes that you have in your body, And a gene is something responsible for coding for a protein. It gives the has the instructions for making a protein. But yet the human genome, it only has 25,000 genes, but it produces 100,000 different kinds of proteins. We used to think that a gene would always code for one protein and one protein only. So in this case, if there were 25,000 genes in the human genome, how many different proteins could we make? Only 25,000. So one gene, one protein. One gene, one protein. But we find out that the proteome, or the number of proteins that our body can make, is 100,000. Right? Notice that the number of proteins that we can make is greater than the number of genes. So that means that every gene can make more than one protein. Some genes maybe make one, other genes maybe two, some genes three, some genes maybe four. Well, now how is that possible? The way that we understand and the terminology we use to describe this right here is called alternative splicing of exons. So if we go back to the previous slide, notice that we have three segments of exons. And this whole pre-messenger RNA, which includes introns and exons, comes from one gene. And depending on how these exons are spliced together, we can get different proteins. So for instance, we could splice these segment number one, number two, and number three together, like what we see right here. That's going to produce one kind of protein. But maybe we can throw out segment number one and throw out segment number three, and we're left over with the middle segment, and that could code for a protein, a different kind of protein. So depending on how the exons are spliced together, then every gene, because of alternative splicing, can produce more than one kind of protein. Yeah.
You said our body can make 100,000 proteins?
Yeah, 100,000 different kinds of proteins in our body. Okay, give me the name of a protein. What's your favorite protein? Anybody know a name of a protein? I'm sorry? Carne asada? Yeah? That is mostly what? You've taken anatomy. What the heck is that? That's like actin and myosin, right? So yeah, actin is a protein. Myosin is a protein. Collagen is a protein. Okay? So collagen is what we find in tendons and ligaments. We don't typically eat that stuff. But it's important. Who has leather? Who's wearing leather shoes? Nobody's wearing leather shoes in here tonight. Okay? But leather is from the reticular layer of the dermis, which is dense, irregular connective tissue, loaded with collagen, right? It's a very strong protein that's in the matrix of that connective tissue. All right, so proteins are very important for structure as well as function. Okay, so alternative splicing, make sure you know the definition of that. So alternative splicing can be used to describe how one gene can produce what? Several different messenger RNAs, which will then produce several different kinds of proteins, even from one gene. Okay, this slide, I'm not going to talk about silencing short interfering RNAs, so that one you can delete. This is sort of an interesting slide because we see these tiny little dots here and here and here and here, right? And all these tiny little dots are ribosomes. What's the function of a ribosome again? To make a protein, protein synthesis, in particular the translation step of protein synthesis. And we can see all of these ribosomes attached to this tiny little string right here. Can your eye pick out a little tiny string right through here? All right. That's the messenger RNA. That's the information that is telling these ribosomes what amino acids belong in that protein and exactly in what order they should go in there. So the messenger RNA, the primary sequence of nucleotides in a messenger RNA determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. And a ribosome will attach to a messenger RNA and will slide down the messenger RNA reading the nucleotides. And when it does that, it's going to incorporate different amino acids into the protein that it's making. So over here, it's just beginning to make a protein. And then by the time the ribosomes ends up way down over here on this end of the messenger RNA, what does that protein look like? It's really long because a lot of amino acids have been added to it, while the protein over here is very short. So in order to add all these amino acids to a protein that's being built, the ribosome has to move down the messenger RNA to do that. So there's a nice correspondence between the sequence of nucleotides in the messenger RNA and the sequence of amino acids in the protein that's being made. All right, so what is this ribosome made out of? Let's talk about the different kinds of RNA. Here we see the messenger RNA. What is a ribosome made out of? It's made out of just rRNA, ribosomal RNA. So just ribosomal RNA makes this workbench for protein synthesis. And didn't I talk about this? Oh, I thought I talked about the three different kinds of RNA. There's tRNA, messenger RNA, and rRNA. The ribosomal RNA goes into making a ribosome. The messenger RNA describes the primary sequence of amino acids to make a protein. And the tRNA is a special taxi RNA. Sometimes I call that taxi RNA. Does that ring a bell now that I said taxi RNA? Because in order, for instance, for an amino acid to be added to this location right here, this is a location that it's always going to be added. So this amino acid is going to be the same because that's the first one was added to this chain, and as the chain gets longer and longer, it gets farther and farther away from the ribosome. So in order for this ribosome to add another amino acid to this chain of amino acids that are growing, or the protein, an amino acid has to come from the cytosol someplace to the ribosome to be put in there. Okay? And there's a special RNA that goes around and looks for amino acids in the cytoplasm and brings it over to the ribosome so that it can be incorporated into the growing protein. And that's called the transfer RNA. So the transfer RNA is looking for the different amino acids, bringing them over to the ribosome so that they can be put in the right location in this protein that's getting longer and longer and longer and longer. So that's the job of the transfer RNA. So basically, we got those three kinds: transfer, ribosomal, and messenger RNA. All right, so a ribosome doesn't read just one nucleotide to figure out what amino acid belongs in the protein at a particular location. Because how many different nucleotides are there? How many different nucleotides are there in RNA? There's adenine, there's uracil, there's cytosine, and guanine, right? So there's only four nucleotides. But how many amino acids are there? Are there four amino acids? If there are four amino acids, then that would be easy. You'd only need one nucleotide to code for what amino acid to come in to be put into the protein. But how many amino acids are there? There are 20, right? So in order for a nucleotide to code for a particular amino acid, there's got to be more than one, or actually more than four, okay? And so what has happened in nature is that since there are only four nucleotides, it takes three of them to code for a particular amino acid. So for instance, when there is a sequence of uracil, cytosine, cytosine, that's going to code for one amino acid, and that amino acid is serine. So here's a list of different amino acids. They're going to have different side chains in that R position for that amino acid that you're looking at. And this sequence of three nucleotides in the messenger RNA is what we call a codon. So what we're looking at right here is really a nice description of the universal genetic code that shows us what kind of code in RNA determines a particular amino acid in the protein that's growing. So for instance, if glycine should be incorporated into a protein, what is the codon that has to be in messenger RNA to make sure that glycine gets put into that location? It's got to be guanine, guanine, cytosine. So it's got to be a triplet. So the universal genetic code is what we call a triplet code, right? Because there's only four nucleotides, and we got 20 different amino acids, so we need this triplet code right here in order to code for a particular amino acid. Okay. Now, let's look at the DNA. That's a triplet too, because what's going to... So here we have thymine, adenine, cytosine. So to make a RNA molecule, what's going to base pair with thymine to make an RNA? Okay. Thymine is going to base pair with adenine. And then here's an adenine in DNA. What is that going to code for in RNA? It can't be thymine because you don't have thymines in RNA. It's got to be a uracil, and indeed that's where it is. And what's going to base pair with cytosine? The guanine. All right, so here is that first triplet on a messenger RNA. That's AUG. This is the start signal. And a lot of times it incorporates methionine. Okay, it's just a methylated amino acid, and that's a start sign. So just like when you have a sentence, how do you know you're at the beginning of a sentence? Capital letter. Okay, what happens if you're at the beginning of a sentence in Spanish and it's a question? What do you got?
Okay.
Yeah? You got a question mark, right? So the beginning of a sentence has control information telling this DNA, this translation step, where to start and where to stop. What's at the end of a sentence? A period. But on a messenger RNA, it doesn't have a period because it doesn't work in English or a written language, right? It works in a nucleotide language. And what's the stop sign in nucleotide language? It is UAG. Right? And UAG is how many nucleotides? It's three, right? It's just three nucleotides put together, and that looks like a period to RNA polymerase. That looks like a period at an end of a sentence. Okay. So I guess I would like for you to know that this codon is in messenger RNA. So in your notes, it maybe actually put a mRNA right there. It's not in ribosomal RNA. It's not in transfer RNA. It's in the ribosomal RNA. And so the messenger RNA right here most directly correlates to what? The sequence of amino acids in a protein. Not the ribosomal RNA or the transfer RNA. It's the messenger RNA. All right, so let's look at this diagram right here. So here we have, how many strands does this molecule look like? It looks like two, double-stranded. What kind of nucleotide is double-stranded? It's DNA. Now, we could double-check because in DNA, there's a kind of nucleotide that we only find in DNA and not RNA. What's that? That's thymine. What should we not find in DNA? Uracil, right? So if we look at these nucleotides, we see thymine right here, but nowhere is there a uracil. So indeed, that confirms our understanding that this is DNA nucleic acid. And, okay, so this sequence of nucleotides in DNA is what we call just a primary sequence of nucleotides. That's going to be used to make, to determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. So all of these are different amino acids. Serine is an amino acid, isoleucine, glycine, alanine. These are amino acids. So how is that accomplished? Well, first, what's the first step in protein synthesis? What about this DNA? Does this DNA ever leave the nucleus and go wandering around the cytoplasm? No, because it could get damaged. And if it's damaged, that's the end of that cell. It dies, right? So what's the first step? Making a copy of this DNA that can leave the nucleus. What's that called? Making a copy, making a photocopy of this DNA. That is called transcription. Transcription. Okay, so the first step, and this happens in the nucleus, is transcription. So the DNA molecule has to unzip. So here is one strand of this double-stranded DNA. All right, so I see TA? Is that an A? TA? I don't know if I can see that. All right, but anyway, so here is the DNA that's been unzipped, TACCCG. This is the primary sequence of nucleotides in this DNA molecule. And RNA is going to be made by RNA polymerase, for instance. And so what's going to pair with thymine? RNA polymerase is going to stick a adenine right there, and the adenine in DNA is going to base pair with uracil, right? And then a guanine is going to pair with a cytosine in DNA. Ah, but from the previous slide, what's AUG? That's a start sign, right? That's the start sign for protein synthesis. So that makes beautiful sense to us. So what do we call this first sequence of three nucleotides? Okay, this is actually going to make the messenger RNA over here. So this first triplet of nucleotides is what we call a codon. That's a codon. All right. So AUG is codon number one. A codon is three nucleotides. And then who can tell me what the next codon is? GGC. And can you see how it base pairs up with a DNA molecule? Well, GGC is really easy because you don't have to swap anything around. It is what? It's going to be CCG. That's the sequence of nucleotides in DNA that's going to code for GGC sequence of nucleotides in the messenger RNA. And on and on and on down the line. So every three nucleotides is going to be a codon. And that's going to be useful information because what does each codon code for? So for instance, this AUC, what does AUC stand for? We don't have it on this list. Okay, sorry. But we can tell. Isoleucine right here, AUC. Okay, so it's easy to find a table someplace that has the code for every particular amino acid. It's going to be a different triplet, a different codon. So this messenger RNA here has to be inserted into the ribosome, and the ribosome then is going to just read one triplet code, the next triplet, and the next triplet, and the transfer RNA is going to bring over the proper amino acid, and that proper amino acid is going to be joined by a dehydration synthesis reaction to the neighboring amino acid that was there previously. And the protein is just going to grow bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you get to the end, what's at the end of this messenger RNA? The stop sign, which is going to be an AUG signal. Okay. Stop is UAG. UAG. Okay. All right, so here you see your DNA. Here's the RNA. But of course, before this RNA can go out into the cytoplasm, what does it have to do? It has to unzip or detach from the DNA molecule. Now, how difficult is that? And why? It's not difficult. Why is that not difficult to do? Because of the bonding between the base pairs right here are hydrogen bonds, which are weak bonds. So it's easy to zip and unzip this molecule apart, and they fit just perfectly because of the length of those bonds and also the number and location of the hydrogen bonds between different nucleotides. Okay. So this is protein synthesis. So going from this step here to where you have a nice messenger RNA made, what is that step called? Making this messenger RNA and using DNA as a template. Sorry. Transcription. That's transcription. And where does that happen? In the nucleus, because the DNA can never leave the nucleus. Right? So transcription is the process of base pairing and using DNA as a template to make the complementary RNA strand, and then this is going to unzip, go into the cytoplasm. Messenger RNA is going to combine with a ribosome, and along with transfer RNA, these amino acids are going to be joined together just in this particular sequence. So what kind of structure do we call this particular sequence of amino acids in a protein?
Primary.
That's primary structure. Okay, and this primary structure of this protein is going to determine what structure of a protein? The secondary structure, which then determines the tertiary structure, then might determine the quaternary structure of proteins coming together. All right, so the primary structure of this protein that is made, what's it determined by? What's the building block for this primary structure of this protein?
Nucleotides.
Okay, it's the primary structure of nucleotides in messenger RNA. And what determines the primary structure of nucleotides in the messenger RNA? It's the primary structure of nucleotides in DNA. So we went backwards. In real life, what happens? It's the primary structure in DNA that determines the primary structure in messenger RNA. We call that transcription. And then the primary structure of messenger RNA determines the primary structure of a protein, and that's what we call translation, right? So if we're going from a nucleotide language to nucleotide language, that's transcription. We're just making an exact copy. These nucleotides are almost identical. But going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language, what's that? That's translation. It's two different languages, right? That's translation. So you should know where that happens to. Okay. The transfer RNA looks something like this. And this segment on a transfer RNA can hydrogen bond with the codon of the messenger RNA. And so that's what selects for a particular amino acid at a particular location. All right, so for instance, let's look at codon number 2. It's GGC. So that part of the transfer RNA can associate with GGC. What should be the nucleotide sequence of a transfer RNA at GGC? It should be what? CCG. And then it will base pair very nicely, and so then it will automatically know to put a glycine in at that particular location. Okay, so I don't know what we have right here. That's what, UUA? I can't quite read it. UUA. I don't have any idea what UUA is. You won't have to know what it is either. Okay. But, all right, let's go back and look at UUA. So, what is the triplet code on a messenger RNA that UUA will be able to base pair with? It's going to be AAU. And that will fit perfectly together. And so this particular taxi RNA or transfer RNA will only bring in one specific amino acid determined by this end of the transfer RNA. Okay. So this area right here is complementary to the codon. So if this is the codon on messenger RNA, the corresponding area on the transfer RNA is called the anticodon. The anticodon cannot specify the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. It is what part? It's called the codon determines what amino acid gets placed into position in a protein. Okay, let me just see what I want to talk about right here. Okay, so ribosomal RNA makes a ribosome. Transfer RNA has anticodons, and these anticodons can base pair to the triplet, which are called codons on a messenger RNA. So for instance, here is a nice ribosome. Here is the growing amino acid. So here's the first, here's the growing protein. So here's the first amino acid that was placed in this protein. Here's the second one. Here's the third one. And here you can see that tunnel going through the ribosome, and the messenger RNA is going through it. And we can just see that the transfer RNA is going to base pair with the codon. And so doing, it's going to bring in an amino acid, and then it's going to form a peptide bond right here. And then what's going to happen to this ribosome? It's going to move up to read the next triplet. Okay, and then this transfer RNA is going to fly away, and then another one bringing the next amino acid will bind to this triplet right here. And after it binds, what happens? Amino acid number 6 will be joined to amino acid number 5, and the sequence gets longer and longer and longer as this ribosome moves down the messenger RNA. So let me just ask you, this triplet right here on a messenger RNA, what do we call that? What do we call this triplet right here? That's called the codon. That's the codon. And if you look back at that universal genetic code, right, it's the codon that determines what protein is put in that location, not the anticodon. Okay, so functions of Rough ER, I think you're kind of familiar with that already. Rough ER has ribosomes, right, so they attach to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, and then there's a little channel. And so the ribosome is stationary, and what moves is the messenger RNA through the ribosome. And as the messenger RNA moves through the ribosome, this protein goes through the ribosome and through this channel in the membrane and ends up inside what we call the cisterna of the endoplasmic reticulum. So proteins that are made by ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum end up inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And because they're inside the endoplasmic reticulum, then they are never released into the cytoplasm. They're placed inside a vesicle by the Golgi apparatus, and they can be used for excretion outside the cell. Or they can be trapped inside that vesicle inside the cell for their entire lifespan. So can you name any vesicles inside the cell that contain proteins? And what those jobs might be? Probably. We learned of two important kinds of vesicles inside of a cell that have a function. Two important vesicles inside the cell. Lysosome. What's the protein inside a lysosome? It's called lysozyme. And what's the function of lysozyme? It's a digestive enzyme that will break macromolecules apart. Okay, that comes from protein synthesis on endoplasmic reticulum. What's another kind of vesicle? Peroxisome. What's its function? Detoxification, because it makes peroxidase. That's an enzyme that breaks down, for instance, hydrogen peroxide, and that's inside a vesicle too. Okay, and so those enzymes come from just this kind of process that we see right here. Okay, so proteins that are secreted leave the endoplasmic reticulum in vesicles. Oh, but what kind of endoplasmic reticulum is this in particular? Rough, it's got to be rough. It's got to have ribosomes, otherwise it won't be able to make that protein, right? Leave the R in vesicles, go to the Golgi body. In the Golgi complex, then these sometimes are conjugated with carbohydrates or maybe with lipids to make them glycoproteins or lipoproteins. And then these modified proteins leave the Golgi to become lysosomes or for products for exocytosis. But mucus, and we're all familiar with mucus, right, because you've all had a cold, that stuff that comes running out of your nose, right, that's moco. That's a protein that's been modified with a sugar. So it's neither sugar or protein. It's what we call a mucopolysaccharide or a glycoprotein. And that is excreted from cells. Oh, what kind of cells secrete mucus? You should know that. I won't tell you. Okay. I won't tell you. You could look that up. All right. Many proteins are not structural in nature, right, but are more functional in nature. Proteases, for instance, are enzymes that break down proteins. We find that in lysosomes. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay, DNA. And we talked about mitosis, right? I think we talked about mitosis already. Or in anatomy, you learn mitosis. What's the basic understanding of mitosis? Cell division. What do you start with? A parent cell, right? And what happens? What do you get? Two daughter cells. What's the difference between these daughter cells? Nothing. In a science fiction way of thinking about it, these daughter cells are clones of each other. They're identical, right? And they're just identical to this parent cell as well. So this would be mitosis. Mitosis is just a form of asexual reproduction. Because how is this daughter cell different than the parent cell? It's not different. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not different. That's why we call that asexual reproduction. Because asexual reproduction just produces the same thing over and over again, or a clone of each other. All right, but all right. So think of you compared to your parents. Are you exactly like either of your parents? No, you might be kind of close sometimes, depending, but you're not. So is that asexual reproduction? No, that's sexual reproduction. So the purpose of sexual reproduction is to produce what? Differences in everybody, diversity in everybody. Okay, but mitosis isn't for that purpose. Mitosis is to produce the same cells over and over and over again. And you should probably have on the tip of your tongue why. Why is there mitosis? Why do you produce cells over and over and over again? Cells die, you need to replace them. Okay. And at one point in time, you were just a single cell. That's called a zygote, when an egg and a sperm come together to make a single cell. That's a zygote. And we were all zygotes at one time, but that's not a really exciting stage of life, because if you were just a zygote, you couldn't come to physiology class and take notes, right? So you need to be made up of what? Trillions of cells. In order to be made up trillions of cells, you need mitosis. So growth is another reason for mitosis. Okay. So how many chromosomes does this parent cell have? Anybody have a clue? You learn this in a biology class, but I think it's kind of fun to even understand a little bit of this in a physiology class. There are 46 chromosomes, right? But it's a special kind of arrangement. You actually have two sets of chromosomes. And the sets have an equal number, so that means they each have 23, right? A number 1, a number 2, all the way down to 23. And then over here, you got another set, a different number 1 and a different number 2. The ones are really similar, but the ones are different than the 2s. They're pretty dissimilar. All the way down to what? 23 right here. So you got two sets. And do you know where these sets come from? Your parents. So one set you get from your mom, right? The second set you get from your dad. So we say papa right there. Not really. These are what? Maternal, and these are paternal chromosomes. Okay. And so what do these daughter cells have? We said what? They're identical to the parent cell, so it's going to have exactly the same thing that's in the parent cell over there, right? Two sets of chromosomes. One all the way down to 23, and then the paternal set all the way down to 23, and the same with this one up over here. Well, if you have this parent cell and you divide it in half, how is it that you get the same number of chromosomes as what's in this cell?
Copy.
Yeah. You just have to make another copy of it. Right, so during the growth phase of the cell cycle, which we call interphase, these chromosomes over here are what we call replicated. Or you could say duplicated, but that's really not the correct term. They're replicated. Another copy of this one is made, and another copy of that one is made. So you got two copies of this one, so that when it splits, one goes up here and one goes down here, and you have the same number. So replication is very important. That happens during interphase. All right, so that's what this slide means. When cells divide by what process? Mitosis, the DNA has to replicate itself and identical copies go to the two daughter cells. So how is that done? Well, you kind of saw how there's a high fidelity in transcription where you have a primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA and that is transcribed into an identical, right, copy in RNA. So DNA can be used as a template to make more of itself. So first there has to be a helicase that breaks the hydrogen bonds to produce two free strands of DNA. All right, so in order for DNA replication to take place, we can't use an RNA polymerase. We use a different enzyme. All right, we call that DNA polymerase. It's a similar kind of thing. It's going to make a polymer, but in this case, it's not an RNA polymer. It's what? DNA, because we're interested in making more DNA. Alright, so the DNA polymerase binds to each strand and makes a new complementary strand of the old one. So the old strands act as a template. And you maybe have used templates before. Maybe you've used a template to make something for your car that has to fit just in the right spot or something. Or if you ever sew or whatever, you have a template that you use to cut out patterns. Right? So what are the nucleotides? AT and GC are the base pairing rules, and those are the nucleotides that are used. And in replication, we say that it is semi-conservative. That just means that the original DNA sequence is preserved, but in the new DNA molecule that is made, it is one old strand and one new strand put together. So let's look and see what that means. So here is, where's our ruler? On the top of the slide, you see the DNA strand that's going to be replicated. All right, so here is the old DNA molecule that's going to be replicated. So before we can replicate it, what has to happen to this molecule? It's got to unzip. What's the name of that enzyme that unzips it? It's called the helicase. Helicase. It unzips the molecule. So now we can see the bases in both strands of the DNA molecule. Well, more DNA nucleotides will base pair according to the rules, right, on both strands. Right? And so here is one old strand. This old strand never breaks. If it breaks, then that information gets lost. So this sequence, TGCAGA, remains the same, never changes. Because why? The DNA molecule never breaks apart. So that just means that the new DNA molecule that's being brought in, okay, is going to base pair according to the old primary sequence of this old strand right here. All right, so when we get down to this new molecule that's formed, we got what? One old strand and one new strand that's put together. And the old strand acts as a template for making the new strand because of the base pairing rules. The same thing over here. Here's the old strand. It acts as a template for incorporating new DNA nucleotides. Right? And so here is the new strand, and here is the old strand. So both of these new nucleic acids have one old strand, one new strand, one old strand, and one new strand. So we call that semi-conservative. If it was completely conservative, you'd have what? Both old strands over here and both new strands over here. But then you couldn't use the old strand as a template for making the new one. And the genes would change as a result of that. Because remember, the sequence of nucleotides here, the primary sequence determines the primary sequence in a protein through transcription and translation. So that's what semi-conservative replication means. Oh, you mean we didn't talk about the cell cycle? Oh, we didn't talk about mitosis yet. Okay, well, let's talk about it quickly now. We talked a lot about it already. Okay. Most cells of the body are an interphase. That's a growth phase. That's not an active form of mitosis. And that's where DNA replication takes place. All right, so you start with 46 chromosomes and then they're replicated. Okay, so that when the cell divides, both daughter cells get a copy of the DNA. Nobody's left out. All right, so here is a nice picture of the cell cycle, which includes mitosis. Interphase is broken down into three different phases. There's G1, there's S, and G2. So this is not cell replication, this just is the growth phase. Right, so during G1, the cell is just performing its normal kind of functions, whatever this cell is designed to do. Maybe it's an endocrine cell secreting some kind of hormone. So it's going to be doing that in this phase right here, its normal physiologic role. Then the cell is going to go into S phase. During S phase, the DNA is replicated because this has to happen before mitosis, otherwise one of the daughter cells is going to be missing DNA. Right, so that won't work. So S phase is DNA replication. And then, well, not only that, but what else has to be duplicated or replicated if the cell is going to split in half? What are some other organelles inside of a cell? How about centrioles? Centrioles? You don't want one daughter cell to get the centrioles and none up over here. So centrioles have to do what? They have to duplicate themselves as well. And the Golgi body, right, and mitochondria, and all those have to duplicate. Okay. All right, so then the G2 phase is the final growth phase before mitosis can start. There are probably many more microtubules that have to be built before mitosis can take place, and that happens during this phase right here. And then we get into an active mitosis cycle, and mitosis is characterized by prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And a part of telophase is a cytokinesis. So I don't know if I like this diagram very much in your book. I would actually like to have cytokinesis as a part of telophase inside here someplace. Okay. So I think this is just kind of a review from anatomy. So I'm going to go over this pretty quick. Prophase is characterized by extended chromatin, which looks like this, that's all pulled away from a chromosome that's being used, and maybe the DNA strands are separated. All right, that DNA is inside the nucleus, so it's relatively safe. Prophase is characterized by that extended chromatin condensing into these little chromosomes right here. And it's packaged in those histones. Oh, I'm sure we talked about histones. Those proteins that the DNA is wrapped around and it becomes protected. All right, and so prophase is characterized by the formation of these chromosomes. We call that condensed chromatin. And you see a nuclear envelope? It's gone. The nuclear envelope disappears during prophase. And I have a pair of centrioles over here and a pair over here. They move to opposite poles of the cell, and they start to arrange these microtubules to form a spindle apparatus. These are all nice characterizations of prophase. And the spindle apparatus then searches out a chromosome and attaches every chromosome at a location called a centromere to these microtubules. And what's the job of that microtubule again? What can it do? It can move things around inside the cell, right? They're like little monorails that can position things. Okay? So prophase is characterized by these microtubules grabbing hold of these chromosomes and starting to adjust them around and so that they all end up right smack in the equator of the cell. Right? When they're at the equator of the cell, we call that metaphase. So that's how we would characterize metaphase. Spindle apparatus is complete. Chromosomes have all been attached at the centromere. And notice that these chromosomes here, what letter of the alphabet do they kind of look like? An X. And the reason why they look like an X is why? That sounds really strange. Here is just one chromosome. Okay? Here's a centromere. When it's replicated, this chromosome looks like what? Twice as many as what we see is going to look like this, which looks like an X, right? So this is a replicated chromosome, and that's what we see in that diagram right there. Replicated chromosome. Replicated by what? Semi-conservative replication. The old strand acts as a template. So that these things right here are what we call sister chromatids, because here's one and here's the other one. So they're sister chromatids. And now they're lined up in the middle of the cell, and they can separate. The sister chromatids can separate to opposite poles of the cell. That's how we characterize anaphase. The replicated chromosomes separate. They rip apart at the centromere, and they get pulled to opposite ends of the cell. They're hopping a ride. And then telophase is when the nuclear envelope reappears, and instead of having condensed chromatin, it starts to extend, and maybe it's being used to make RNA again. Transcription starts. And can you see the cell starting to pinch apart here a little bit? That's what we call a cleavage furrow. So the cleavage furrow develops during telophase. And when that cleavage furrow develops, it's like taking a balloon and starting to pinch it apart, so the organelles end up in two different parts of that cell. It's the pinching apart of one cell into two. That's what we call cytokinesis. And cytokinesis occurs during telophase. So that's probably what I would like for you to know. Cytokinesis happens during telophase. Your book might say something a little bit different, and it's probably going to be discussed by scientists for the next 200 years, when cytokinesis happens and when doesn't it happen and what kind of cells do it, when and whatever. But for this class, just say cytokinesis is what? A process that happens during telophase. Okay, it's that process of the cell pinching apart. So a good way to think of it is mitosis is the separation of chromosomes into two daughter cells, right? But cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. So inherently it's just maybe a little bit way of thinking about it. Mitosis is the separation of chromosomes. Cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. Okay? Okay. Okay. So this basically just shows you what I've shown you already. Here's the centromere. That's where the spindle apparatus attaches to. And this is a chromatid. And compared to this chromatid over here, they should be identical. So we call those sister chromatids. Those are the things that separate. So I'm not going to test you on anything of the cyclins. Oncogenes, I'm not going to talk about oncogenes either. You can, and cell death. Okay, so we talked about these four stages already. Let's see if your book says anything different than what I said. Not really. Yeah? Cell death. You might want to know the definition for a normal... Well, okay, let's go... Actually, these definitions aren't bad. Cell death can happen by a couple of different processes. One that is scheduled to happen, and another cell death process that is not scheduled to happen. It's a surprise. Not necessarily a good surprise. All right, so necrosis is cell death occurs when some kind of pathological condition or process kills a normal cell. It becomes necrotic. Maybe you cut off blood supply to your heart. All right, and those cells die. That part of the heart that's been deprived of oxygen becomes necrotic. It's just dead tissue. It's a scar, and hopefully it's just a really small area. Otherwise, that patient's not going to survive. All right, that's cell death. Other kinds of cell death, which we call apoptosis, occurs under normal physiologic conditions. There are certain cells that only have a certain lifespan. And from the very beginning, everybody knows that, and after a certain period of time, they die. All right, and then they're replaced by new cells. All right, so apoptosis is a normal physiologic response. Sometimes we call this programmed cell death, and that's just a normal process. As opposed to necrosis is what? That's a pathological process. And that's I just want you to know the definitions of these two terms right here. Okay, so looking back at mitosis, you got prophase, what did I say? Nuclear envelope disappears. All right, chromosomes become visible, I agree with that. But they also attach to the spindle apparatus at what location of the chromosome? That thing called the centromere right here, right at that centromere. Okay. Metaphase, chromosomes just line up at the equator, and they're moved there by the spindle apparatus. Anaphase, that means that the sister chromatids split apart and they're pulled to opposite poles of the cell. And during telophase, the cytoplasm is divided into two different cells. We call that cytokinesis. So here I see extended chromatin all over the place and a nuclear envelope, so this is interphase. And I would say this is prophase because I don't see a nuclear envelope. What about the centrioles? Do I see centrioles anywhere? Not really, but they put them in the diagram, thank goodness. So here we see the centrioles moving to opposite poles of the cell and the spindle apparatus is forming. You know this is metaphase because the chromosomes are all lined up. Here's one centrosome, here's the other centrosome with a nice spindle apparatus in between them, and here is a nice picture of anaphase because you can see the sister chromatids being separated, pulled to opposite sides of the cell. And this one right here, of course, don't be confused. It almost looks like metaphase, but this right here is really just a cleavage furrow forming. So this is the last phase of mitosis, telophase, and the cell is pinching into two. That process we call cytokinesis. Centrosome. I think we talked about the centrosome already. It contains two centrioles. It organizes the microtubules within the cell. It's duplicated during G1 if the cell is going to divide. Right? So microtubules grow from centrosomes to form the spindle apparatus. And then they attach to the centromeres of each of those chromosomes, and the spindle fibers pull the chromosomes to opposite poles of the cell. The ends of the sister chromatids are called telomeres. Right at the very tips. So So a telomere, I don't know if I have a picture. So here's a telomere of a chromosome. And every time a cell divides, a little bit of this breaks off and off and breaks off every time the cell divides. And then sooner or later, you can imagine what's going to happen. You're going to run out of chromosomes. So what's going to happen to that cell then? It's going to die. And that's just a normal process. What do we call that normal process of cell death? Yeah, apoptosis. So this is one example of how that happens. Because you don't want cells to divide and divide uncontrollably. What is that condition called when a cell divides uncontrollably in your body? Cancer, right? And so here might be one explanation for why those cells don't die. Maybe these telomeres aren't being chopped off properly. Maybe there's an enzyme that's missing from cancer cells that isn't chopping off that telomere. So something isn't signaling normal cell death. So normal cell death is certainly a very important part of normal physiology. Okay. And the enzyme that chops a little bit of the telomere off is called telomerase. Okay, meiosis. I want to say just a little something about meiosis. See, when did we start? 4:30 to 5:30? Okay, we got a couple minutes. I'm not going to go in detail into meiosis, but I think I want you to know some general things about meiosis. All right, so what does mitosis produce? Yeah, two identical daughter cells, right? Okay. And there's no nuclear reduction. You have the same number of chromosomes in the two daughter cells compared to the parent cell. So how would you explain that? What has to happen between this parent cell and these two daughter cells before they split apart? Replication, DNA replication. The DNA has to replicate itself so that you get an extra copy of the DNA so that each cell gets a copy, doesn't get shorted out. Okay. The way that we talk about this cell right here, since it has two copies of every chromosome, we call this a diploid cell. That's a diploid cell because it has two copies. It has a maternal copy and a paternal copy of every single one. A way that we can abbreviate that is by calling it a 2N, N standing for just a copy of that DNA. What about these daughter cells over here? What's the ploidy of this daughter cell? What's the ploidy of this daughter cell? How is this daughter cell different than the parent cell? Okay, in mitosis, they should be exactly the same. They're like clones with each other. All right, so what's the ploidy of the parent cell? Okay. I heard a lot, Let me pick on somebody. What's the ploidy of the parent cell? Way in the back. What's the ploidy of the parent cell? Yeah, but what's the ploidy of it? How would we talk about the ploidy of this cell? Ploidy. It is diploid, right? Because there's two copies of every chromosome. That's the ploidy of the cell. It is diploid. It has two copies. So, my question is, what's the ploidy of this daughter cell? Diploid. Because it's got to be the same as the parent cell. Now, you're not used to using this terminology, so it seems strange, but I'm trying to get people familiar with it a little bit. Okay. So the ploidy of this daughter cell is diploid. Okay. Well, this is not meiosis, this is mitosis, right? For growth and replacing old and damaged cells. But every once in a while, right, we're interested in sexual reproduction. And the bottom line is that sexual reproduction is going to produce something that looks like this, which is that's a sperm, and here is an egg, or an oocyte, all right, sperm. And here is what we call a germ cell. And a germ cell has two sets of chromosomes, which is, what's the ploidy of a germ cell? It's diploid, it's got two sets, right? So what's a short way of saying diploid? 2N. All right. And it's going to produce, all right, either one of these, not both of those, right? If it's a male, it's going to produce a sperm. If it's female, it's going to produce egg. This is the process of meiosis. All right, so there's just going to be one set here, all the way down to number 23. And, of course, in the egg, the same thing, all the way down to number 23, like this. So what's the, and you don't know the answer to this, I'm going to have to tell you. What's the ploidy of this cell? Okay, somebody might know this is true. It's not diploid because it only has half the number of chromosomes, so we call it haploid. H-A-P-L-O-I-D. That's the ploidy of an egg and a sperm. So does it have the same number of chromosomes? No, it's cut in half. That's the purpose of meiosis. Now, why is that a really good thing? Because what's going to happen? Well, this sperm and this egg are going to fuse together to form this cell right here. They're going to form a cell. And I'm not sure I ever told you what the name of this cell is, but we were all one of these at one time. This is what we call a zygote. Okay, that's a zygote. And so what's the ploidy of this zygote? It is back to diploid again, because it's got one set from... Oh, I tell you what, let's say here. Let's do this one because that's M. One all the way down to 23. And one paternal set from the sperm. One, two, all the way down to number 23. All right, so all of the cells are back to what? That diploid nature. Half of the chromosomes from our dad, half from our mom. And what is this process called? I should give you like 1 second. Okay. No. Ah, extra credit. What's it called? Nobody said. Okay, nobody gets extra credit. But, you know, you all know this one. That's called fertilization. That's fertilization. So here's fertilization. So right now, I'm sure you guys know more than you think you know, but it has to be organized properly in your mind. Okay. So that's fertilization, going from what? Haploid back to diploid. These things right here, a sperm and an egg, go by a general name. Those are both what we call gametes. So let's use some of this terminology again. What's the ploidy of a gamete? Haploid. Why is it a good thing that it's haploid? Because when two gametes come together, they form a diploid cell, which is what most of the cells in our body are, diploid cells. So this is what, the whole life cycle, because this zygote here, is it going to undergo what? For growth. Mitosis, right? And then you're going to grow up and get big that way. Okay. All right, so how does meiosis work? It has divisions which are similar to mitosis, but instead of having one round, there are two rounds. So there's prophase, there's metaphase, anaphase, telophase, but there's two rounds of it. So there's anaphase 1, okay, metaphase 1, anaphase 1, telophase 1. And then you start the second round, which is what? Prophase 2, metaphase 2, anaphase 2, telophase 2 is how meiosis works. And let's see if we have some pictures. So the first division, the homologous chromosomes pair along the equator of the cell rather than singly during mitosis, and one member of a homolog pair is pulled to each pole of the cell. This gives a daughter cell with 23 different chromosomes consisting of two chromatids. Well, what the heck does that mean? What's a homologous pair? A homologous pair right here means is number one is the number one from your mom is homologous to the number one from your dad. That's the homologous pair because they're similar to each other. Number one is not similar to number two, even from the same parent, and it's certainly not the same as a different chromosome from the opposite parent. So number one and number one are what we call homologous chromosomes. They're almost identical. They contain the same genes, but those genes code for different things because your mom and dad are different, right? Okay, so that's what happens first. First, these two sets separate from each other, But before mitosis, what does this guy really look like, this number one? What does it really look like? It is a chromosome that has been replicated, so it really looks like that. All right, so this is a number one, and so what does that look like? Pretty much the same thing, but it comes from your other parent, right? So each one of these chromosomes has sister chromatids. So what separates during the first phase of mitosis is that the number one chromosomes separate into two different cells. Hopefully I got a picture of this. All right, the second round. Let's not talk about the second round first. So what happens? The chromosomes condense during prophase. Right, so we can see, and can I see, let's just say these big ones are the number one, because number one really are the biggest chromosomes, and then they get smaller and smaller until you get down to number 23. So these look like, oh, maybe number 12. I just sort of made that up. They're just smaller, right? So we got, what, two number ones, one from your mom, one from your dad, two number 12s, one from your mom, one from your dad. They line up during metaphase one, and what gets pulled apart? Not the chromatids, but what do we call these two chromosomes? How do they relate to each other? They are the homologous chromosomes, right? One from your mom, one from your dad. They get separated, but they don't get separated so that all of the dad goes to one side and all the mom goes to the other side. It's just what? Some random arrangement. Right? There's no way to know which one you got from, which ones are paternal and which ones are maternal. Oh, look, they're colored. Did you see that? There's no chart right here. But let's just say, which one, and then what is that, blue or pink?
Blue.
Purple. Okay, so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But anyway, let's just say the red is paternal and the blue is maternal. So in this particular case, right, we got one from the dad and one from the mom just randomly coming over here. And then, of course, then the opposite has to happen from this cell over here, right, because they can't end up both in the same side. All right, so now the cells separate, and what do we got? What's the ploidy of this cell right here? It only has one set. It should have a number one, a number two, all the way down to number 23, but it's going to be just some random mixture of which ones come from your mom and which one comes from your dad. That's why kids just have just a random sampling of their parents, because this is completely random what chromosome goes into which cell right here. Okay, but we're not done. Okay, so what we want to do now, we still have replicated chromosomes here. That's the job of meiosis II. And you're going to go through the same steps, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. And so what happens during anaphase II? What do we call these two parts of this replicated chromosome? Those are the sister chromatids. Yeah, sister chromatids. The sister chromatids now separate, and cytokinesis takes place, so you end up with, right, four cells over here, and these cells are all different. So these are all different gametes. And how many chromosomes do they have? They don't have sets, right? They don't have sets. They just have a number one, a number two, a number three, all the way down to number 23. So these are haploid cells. So these really are gametes. These are gametes. And in this case, it kind of looks like what? It looks like eggs. If it was a sperm, it would have a little flagellum right there. So that's what that previous slide really means. Okay, these two previous slides. The first division, the homologous chromosomes separate. And then the second part of meiosis, the sister chromatids separate. And that produces a nuclear reduction. Namely, it forms these four haploid cells. But it's okay, they're haploid, because they don't grow up to be an individual, they have to be fertilized first. So we have to add DNA to them, and then they get back to being diploid. And this is all assuming that normal circumstances operate. Okay, and I'm not going to talk about the last two slides. Unless I change my mind next time. But I don't think I will. So probably on the tip of your tongue, you should be able to characterize the difference between meiosis and mitosis a number of different ways. And in terms of molecules, the big difference in mitosis is it's got two rounds of separating. The first round are the homologous chromosomes separate. Meiosis II, the sister chromatids separate. And it's going to end up giving you four cells, four gametes that are haploid. All right, so that's it for tonight. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheets if you haven't already. And that's good. Talk to you later.